right. So we were told, I gave this as a hook before we walked down here. This idea of what does it mean to use that adjective, virtuous, primarily as a descriptor of a person and their character, and only kind of secondarily as a description of, you know, a virtuous act, would only means for Aristotle the kind of act that a person of virtuous character would do in a given circumstance or typically or whatever. So the game of, in the abstract, coming up with examples, coming up with a case, would just be a little bit of a weird game for Aristotle and his students in the Lyceum to be playing. I don't mean that dismissively to call it a game. Philosophers use that like all the time for conversational things. But it would just be a little bit of a strange way to go. I want to just hook out really quickly on that point, something that Marisa and I were talking about as we wandered our way here. We were groping for the noun. Virtue is a noun, right? But the character of having virtue, right? But you might have something really uncouth, like virtuousness, which is just a really gross English word. Like, it's uncouth. We all know what it means, but it's just... Anyway, the good, more refined English word there is virtuosity, right? And I think in English, this just occurred to me as we were kind of walking and talking here, so thank you. This word virtuosity holds on to the older sense of virtue more than the word virtue actually does in English, I think. So we talk about, like, Yo-Yo Ma, the world-class cellist, his virtuosity as a cellist, right? Mm-hmm. Other cellists are not, like, bad people. They're not even necessarily bad cellists. They're just still aspiring toward what Yo-Yo Ma has attained, toward what he exemplifies, right? So for him to have this virtuosity, for him to be a virtuous and excellent cellist, right? Other cellists, just really objectively, most of them are not as good as he is. They're just not, right? But that doesn't impugn their character. That doesn't make them failures. That doesn't make them bad people, or even in all cases, bad cellists. There are bad cellists, right? I want to leave room for them too, right? But not every cellist always in the history of the world is going to be a supremely excellent cellist. But that doesn't in any way undercut this notion of excellence for cello playing, for musicianship, right? And in fact, we need, perhaps, that ideal of excellence, exemplified in particular people like maybe Yo-Yo Ma, in composers like Mozart. Like, look what he was doing at age, like, 17, right? Like, that kid was just nuts, right? We need those ideals in order that all the rest of us know what to aim for, know what to aspire toward, right? So I just put that out there as a, you know, I think the English word virtuosity holds on to the notion of excellence in a way that the English word virtue doesn't quite. But that's an older usage that kind of got fossilized there in that word virtuosity. So maybe that helps to get a grip on a way into the kind of language that we're using. Questions or thoughts there, or should I go on to a really quirky virtue?
Quirky.
All right. So we get this virtue in Book 4, Chapter 3 of the Nicomachean Ethics. And I'll have, for those who want to read along, I'll have Marisa put up a link to a PDF of a legal free translation, which I think is actually better than most of the current translations. I'm increasingly fond of an excellent translation by Thomas Taylor, who was the first translator to give us the complete works of Plato and the complete works of Aristotle and a whole bunch of other translations and essays on Greek philosophy. He did all of this completely self-taught, as like an ordinary person, like a little bit of help and support from some nobility, living in England in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And he produced like this, I have all of his works at home. It's like 5 feet of books. Like, he had a certain kind of virtue as a scholar, a certain kind of excellence that I can only aspire after. But I'll have Marisa post a link to his translation. He uses occasionally some what are now to us archaic sorts of words, because it was published in 1819. But I think that's actually helpful here in getting us beyond the names and into read the whole paragraph, see how he's using the word, understand the concept, that philosophical disposition of reading. And I think he's just brilliantly poetic and accurate both in a way that the modern translators just can't measure up to, in my judgment. Anyway, book 4, chapter 3. We get this virtue that he and all the more recent translators call magnanimity. Aristotle's word in Greek is megalosukia. Magnanimity comes from Latin, and it means the same thing. Magna or mega means big or great. Suke in Greek, or anima in Latin, means the soul. So to, I think a even more idiomatic translation that would work the same way, but that's Germanic, is great souledness. As like literally like element by element matching the same word in a way that makes it both more immediate to us and also a little bit weird, because it's not a word we use very often. It's kind of uncouth, oh well. Great souledness or magnanimity. Aristotle starts out by talking about this, and he says, you know, the magnanimous person, or the great-souled person, is the person who judges himself or herself to be worthy of great things, and who really is worthy of them. This almost, if you're not careful, sounds like pride or boastfulness or something. But the second half of this, the second half of that definition is really important. And I'll unpack what those great things are in just a minute. But that core thing that we get at the beginning, you know, judging yourself to be worthy of great things when you really are worthy of them. So there always, we said, a virtue for Aristotle is a middle ground or a mean between two different vices. The vices in this case, on the one hand, we have the vice of what you might call pride or arrogance or superciliousness, to use an older word. There, you judge yourself to be worthy of great things, even though you are not. Mm-hmm. Right? On the other hand, we have a vice that we might call pusillanimity or small-souledness. Structurally, same word, right? Mikrosukia, micro in the Greek. But pusillanimity, small-souledness, there we do not judge ourselves to be worthy of as much as we actually are. We undercut our judgment of what our own value is. And so aim at that. So in both of the cases of the vice, we're aiming at not an accurate self-description. We don't have, to go back to Socrates, accurate self-knowledge, accurate self-awareness, if we fall into either of those vices. We take ourselves to be of greater worth and esteem than we actually are, and get kind of this puffed up pridefulness. Or we take ourselves to be of less worth than we actually are. In which case, we don't actually claim the dignity or the honor or the respect that we really are due, even for the kind of person that we are. So there's a sense in which... So those are the two vices that we're kind of threading the needle between. And so I just want to put out one more piece before I ask us for kind of discussion questions around this. And I'll weave in some more pieces, I hope, as we go then after that. But Aristotle asks us then, all right, this begs the obvious question. What are the great things that we might be worthy of. What are, in fact, if this is kind of a excellence, right? This virtue, in a certain sense, number one, gets us to the character of the person in a way these others made harder to get at. But if we really are going to be an excellent person, right? Number one, it's going to involve not being an idiot. And he says that in so many words in this chapter, right? So if you have just a false judgment about your basic self, you're an idiot, and therefore you are not virtuous. Like, you've fallen short.
But if you know you're an idiot?
So then you've still, well, then you've succeeded in self-knowledge, but you've failed in other ways because you're an idiot. Like, you know, so there might be excellent self-knowledge, but there's something about you that is not excellent insofar as you're a moron. Right? Just, duh. he's right, right? And that, too, appeals to this standard of excellence, right? So, you know, accuracy is good, but also being accurate about being great is better than being accurate about being terrible, right? We ought to, you know, we ought to use that self-knowledge about our deficiencies, not just to rest on our laurels, but to know what our deficiencies are and therefore work to correct them. So self-knowledge is critical, but not the only thing.
So usually if you're an idiot, you don't realize it.
It does tend to work out that way, doesn't it? So Aristotle says to us, all right, so say we really are a kind of an all-around virtuous person. You know, we're worthy of great things. If we are worthy of receiving certain kinds of things, whatever those might be, and we're going to find out what those are in about a minute, right? If we are worthy of receiving things, those things are external to us. They, just logically speaking, they can't determine our worth, the having or lacking of them. Because if our being worthy, logically, my being worthy of great things comes first, and then I either do or do not receive the great things that I'm worthy of, if I in fact were to have this virtue, which I don't. But so just logically, we're good with that, right? First, there's the worth of the person. And then secondly, that worth means you are worthy of receiving certain kinds of things. So Aristotle asks us as a thought exercise, all right, what are the things that the greatest beings we can imagine would be worthy of? So he says, all right, what are the gods worthy of receiving? Right? Because the gods are good and awesome and amazing and wonderful in ways that no mortal can aspire to. Maybe on a very rare occasion, like Heracles or someone, we rocket so well that we are elevated to becoming one of the gods. We are divinized. But that itself makes the point, right? What are the gods worthy of? The gods are worthy of honor. Because they lack nothing in themselves. There's nothing they need from us insofar as they're gods. If they needed stuff to be better, like, then they'd be less good than they could possibly be. A supremely good god or goddess, right, needs nothing, and for that very reason is worthy of honor by all of us mortals, right? And so the magnanimous or the great-souled human being is going to be like that insofar as possible for a human being. And that insofar as possible is always a huge, important marker to pin on things, right? So the greatest possible thing that we could be worthy of is honor, the honor of our fellow human beings. And so the only way that you're going to have this virtue of great souledness is to have all of the other virtues going for you already, to be an excellent human being, an exemplar in various ways, is what more than anything else would make you worthy of honor. So if you are in fact wise and just and courageous and temperate and generous and all of these things, that's having the possession and the manifestation of those virtues will make you worthy of honor. Right? And so this, and also, you know, so, you know, wisdom gets the idiot out of the way. You know, other things are going to get other folks out of the way. So this is where we can then think about those two vices, right? The vice of being, you know, arrogant or supercilious. There, you know, you're not actually worthy of honor, but at least you are desiring honor, which is a good thing to have where it's appropriate. Whereas the person, the pusillanimous person, the small-souled person, actually misses the mark by more, Aristotle suggests, because he's not even grabbing after honor, which is the good thing, right? He's grabbing after less esteem than he's really worth. So both he's aiming to, he's just, both he has the, he shares with the other vicious person inaccurate self-knowledge, but he's even not even just grabbing at good things, grabbing at honor, which would be a good thing, and he actually maybe does deserve some of it. So Aristotle says to us that the prideful, the arrogant person imitates the great-souled person, but does not resemble him. He imitates him, but does not resemble him. Whereas the small-souled person doesn't get either of those. Could you speak over the helicopter?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I think I'm getting tripped up a little bit on the word honor, and people say you shouldn't do something for the honor and the glory. And I'm kind of combining glory
you
with
should
honor.
Not I do
should
something?
Not do that. But I, so I'm guess if you can help me understand a little bit more the honor aspect to try and separate some of that. And I may be the only person that's combining those two.
I doubt that. I can try. So,
and I'm sorry, just to add on to that, if you're desiring honor, and if, let's say glory is included in there, and clearly we need to remove that.
Yeah.
But that almost seems like you're doing it for the wrong.
That's excellent, and that might give us a hook on. I don't think it quite even gets us to describe the arrogant person accurately, but it comes close to the arrogant person, right? So, maybe here's the subtle distinction, which is, you know, it's very easy to be a hypocrite about this distinction. And it's very easy, even if we're not wanting to be a hypocrite, nevertheless to self-deceive, which is why we're going to have these vices. But I think that there's a difference between desiring to receive honor and desiring to be worthy of honor.
Mm-hmm.
And the virtue here is the latter, not the former. Right? I think that any human being can desire properly to be worthy of honor. It's not up to me, even if I'm in fact worthy of honor, whether I get it. That's up to all of you. And I literally have no control over you because, like, free will and agency and, like, you're self-movers, right? I can't force you to honor me in any kind of thick, robust sense. And the moment I did, I'd be failing in so many other ways as a human, right? But I nevertheless can and should desire to be worthy of honor. And so that word in the definition kind of, we forgot, it's easy to forget about it, but it's critical. And I think that solves your worry. So the magnanimous person, the great-souled person, is the one who judges herself to be worthy of honor when in fact she really is worthy of honor. And Aristotle even tells us this will entail certain things. The magnanimous person is not going to be going and like showing off and lording it over other people. In exactly the same way that like a champion wrestler is not going to challenge a cripple to an arm wrestling contest. You'd just be a jerk if you did that. Like, yes, I mean, I guess you would win the contest, but the champion marathoner is not going to walk into like the emergency room where people are getting crutches on and say, like, hey, let's have a race. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it just, you're just not going to put yourself out to the world in that way. That would be to undercut this virtue massively, right? So it's not about putting on airs. It's not about lording it over people. It's not even about kind of a condescension, but it's about genuinely being worthy of honor, which speaks to, I think, very clearly, think about the character of the person rather than kind of action by action sorts of analysis. This is a strange virtue, I think, but yet we can find our way in.
It's strange also because honor immediately makes you dependent on others.
Good.
I mean, the worthiness, it doesn't, but
yeah.
To actually have honor.
And that's where the distinction between the worthiness mm-hmm. and the actually being honored
yeah.
happens. And I think that's one of the reasons, among others, why Aristotle used that way in. Like, okay, what are the greatest things for the greatest people to be worthy of? It's honor because that's what the gods are worthy of, right? And insofar as there too, there's been in Greek philosophy for a couple of generations now, before Aristotle, this concern to say that, hey, look, you know, the gods don't need anything from us, including honor.
Like, mm-hmm.
And nevertheless, they are honorable. So he's picking up on this thread and just pulling it a little bit further as he has this. So the great solid person does not need honor, but nevertheless is worthy of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And mm-hmm. like, yeah. And so when we're coming back to the kind of judgments that we make, either in life or after death about people, we might get those judgments wrong. Quite often we do, right? You know, there's a reason why in the old days, for instance, like the Catholic Church would never canonize someone as a saint until everyone who knew them was dead.
Right.
Because they wanted to make sure there were no more skeletons hiding in the closet. Right? And it's a good idea. Like, you wouldn't want to, like, canonize someone, put them on the calendar, make them worthy of reverence, and then it turns out, oh, whoops, they were a child molester.
Yeah.
Like, you would not want that. So by waiting at least a full generation or two until everyone who knew them was dead, you at least massively reduce the chances of that. You can still get it wrong, but I mean, they think for theological reasons that the Holy Spirit protects them from getting it wrong. I don't have a dog in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different... But the idea of, like, hey, let's wait and see, points to we can judge people's character wrongly,
mm-hmm.
but my judging your character doesn't change your character in any way whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
You are still worthy of honor, whether anyone gives it to you or not. Or you are still unworthy of honor, even if you get it
mm-hmm.
or not. Like, nothing about you changed.
Mm-hmm.
All that these moral exemplars are doing is telling the rest of us what to aim at, right? Which is why you kind of get, sort of like the lives of the saints, actually. But in the ancient world, you'd get these kind of biographies of the great philosophers or great other people, like Pythagoras or Plato or Proclus or other, you know, Plotinus. You know, they're disciples, they're students, either right after their life or generations later. Write this kind of idealized biography of them that kind of turns them into a saint of sort. Because the point at a certain point is not a photographic representation of a life. It's about what is the model for a good life? What is the template on which a good life comes? For the later Platonic philosophers, our best text on the theory of how the virtues work and how you grow into virtue is a biography of one of these teachers, precisely because it is so schematic. Like, he attained this, and he attained this, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That it's probably not actually like a day-by-day account of his life, but it's this other account of how virtue works. Sorry.
No, and I'm just wondering if this... So when you were talking about this desire to be worthy of honor,
yeah.
I think a little bit, and I've sort of heard this comparison between resume virtues and eulogy virtues. I'm thinking about this with like Jane Drexler, I think, has often talked about this in sort of Stoic philosophy, but this idea of like being a good person, being worthy of honor, having like, what is it that you would hope for your eulogy to say? That thinking about virtues being like your habits of character, and that's what we're aiming at. And I know that's sort of like loosely related, but that desire, like that worthy of being honorable and living an honorable life.
I think that's groping in the right direction here.
Groping is groping.
Groping is right. Groping is right. Groping is there's a place that I still want to be careful, right? In that we need to be cautious about what, if any, work desire is doing here, right? The person who actually is great-souled, magnanimous in this sense, desires nothing whatsoever. He's already there. Right? He knows, and he knows accurately, that he is worthy of honor. So actually attaining the honor or not is irrelevant to his being worthy of it and knowing that he's worthy of it. Right. Neither of those requires him actually being honored.
After
he's dead or whatever. But like the requirements are, you know, being worthy of that honor and knowing that he's worthy of that honor. Right. So you could think about someone who only gets noticed, you know, in whatever. Like, think about all the famous artists who were just like, who lived in utter poverty their whole life. You know, no one even bought their paintings. Like, they got painted over in some cases, right? But then, like, 100 years later, they're being displayed in the greatest museums in the world and being sold for millions of dollars and all that. You know, they're dead, right? They've been, like, their corpse has rotted. Like, you know, whatever else has happened to their soul, like, they're not around in the same way to receive actual honor. But nevertheless, such a painter, while she was alive, could very well judge accurately that she's worthy of honor as an excellent painter, even though she's not getting it. That's in fact perhaps what keeps her going and what keeps her painting in that little garret apartment while she's starving and dying young and all of this, right? You know, she's not getting the honor that she knows she deserves. But that doesn't matter. She still knows that she's making excellent art. And that's enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be great if she could, like, get paid enough to, like, have better groceries and live a little longer and make more art. Like, there are other things that her life is lacking. But excellence in art is not one of them. Right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that she got ratified later by getting put up in a big famous gallery. Or maybe it didn't. Doesn't matter. But, yeah.
I kind of wanted to maybe draw the lines between this concept of magnanimity and humility, because I don't think it's really come up yet, that word, but I haven't been able to stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
Especially when you started mentioning, like, you know, some of the mystics and canonizing people, but also there are these battling concepts of, like, you know, pride putting us too far over where we're supposed to be and view ourselves. But also this self-doubt and self-deprecation of, like, seeing ourselves as less than worthy of this honor or this stuff. And so this concept of humility, at least to me, when you keep talking about magnanimity and understanding this, like, concept of honor, it's like that self-worth, but that accurate self-worth.
So
I don't know if there's thoughts on so the word, or
I can give you a couple of thoughts now, and maybe the group can kind of help us through this humility question. Like, humility is a weird word.
So is magnanimity.
No, granted. I don't mean to dismiss it. I actually, you know, when I was thinking about, you know, what are, in case the group were, like, totally silent and had nothing at the third stop for things that might be weird to Aristotle, one of the two that I had in mind was humility, right? Mm-hmm. So I mean that it's weird in that sense. Like,
so is he viewed as separate then? Aristotle views humility as a virtue in itself.
I don't think he, I'm not sure he does view it as a. I think we have to be clear about what it means.
Okay.
So let me try to make a first pass at that kind of clarity, and maybe get halfway there, and then we can see what we can do together. I'm putting it out there in that like not final answer, rough first pass that will need some sculpting. But I think it's exactly one of the best places we could be getting triggered to go to at this point. So let me say about that. In the very next chapter, after the magnanimity chapter in the Ethics, Aristotle talks about the virtue of being worthy of receiving whatever it might be. He has a hard time talking about this one. In small matters rather than in great matters. And this, if I remember correctly, is one of the virtues that he thinks is anonymous. That in his day and age, there's not a commonly accepted name for this. So I wonder if some of the things that are part of a certain piece of humility might go under this anonymous virtue. I'd need to read that chapter again and think about it myself. But in just the way that, it's kind of structuring the argument, the two chapters before this were about, on the one hand, like the virtue of like ordinary generosity or liberality with money, of like giving money when it's appropriate to whom it's appropriate and receiving money from whom it's appropriate. And the second part of that's actually really important. But then there's this other virtue of magnificence where it's in great things, like when you are called to put upon a public spectacle, like be the person who's in charge of one of the temple rituals in Athens and has to put on the big feast for the entire city at your own expense. Right? This is the thing, right? There's a virtue of spending well and appropriately, only in the right context on great matters, but also one of like ordinary, like sound financial things of, you know, balancing income and expenses, only giving money to those whom you should appropriately give it to and not to other people, only taking money from those who should be giving it to you and not from those who shouldn't. So like the mob boss probably fails on that end, right? Among others. Sorry. Don't bury me in a waste landfill. But there's that parallel between like the using of money appropriately for magnificent things and the using of money appropriately in the day-to-day. There's a same parallel of being worthy of honor in the greatest ways, magnanimity, and then being worthy of appropriate things in the smaller day-to-day matters, mm-hmm. which has no name. I don't think that's all of humility, but I think that's one piece that sometimes gets hooked into humility. Did you want to help us with this, Juliana?
Well, when she was talking about humility as opposed to magnanimity, I was wondering if he ever distinguished humility from, I might mispronounce this, but
pusillanimity? It's a hard word. I'm going to
use that word. And even if he didn't, you know, what are characteristics that we would see as differences between the two?
So I don't even know. I don't even know what word he would use in Greek to talk about humility, to capture all of what the modern term captures. I think humility is ambiguous in some challenging ways. Like, on the one hand, there's a humility of just knowing that you're not all that big of a deal and not making yourself out to be a bigger deal than you are. So I can think about like the 15-year-old cellist who's only been practicing for about 2 or 3 years and is nowhere near the caliber of Yo-Yo Ma and knows it and doesn't expect to be treated like Yo-Yo Ma as a cellist. Like, doesn't take on the difficult repertoire he would take on, doesn't expect the adulation of the crowds and to be up there with the Boston Symphony or whatever, right? So there's an accurate self-representation. But then there's also what we sometimes call false humility.
Yes.
Where you
that's
make
not real humility.
I know.
I know what you're saying.
But I think that it gets a little bit.
What can be gray from what real, but I guess what I'm saying is that I would almost argue that this true concept of magnanimity and humility, like really like value, like recognizing where you are and what you deserve, because I think that like that false concept of humility, like seeing ourselves as less than worth, like, you know, just self-deprecation is another vice to humility. You cannot be humble and be putting yourself down constantly.
Yeah.
That's not.
And that's actually, when he talks about this pusillanimity in the chapter, one of the reasons why he thinks this is worse than the other vice is that, you know, this is someone, by definition, in his usage, who is worthy of more or even much more than they're claiming. If they are putting themselves that far below actual, genuine worth, imagine if they weren't very worthy, how low yet they would be putting themselves. Look at the temperament they have and just how unhealthy and destructive that is. I think where Aristotle would say that there is a kind of maybe a lesser virtue somewhere in the neighborhood of humility. Let's think about this as we walk. But that we ought, I mean, on the one hand, like, it's better than not to have an accurate self-knowledge. So there may be some kind of a virtue in the neighborhood of self-knowledge, whatever that might be called. But that it's not actually excellent to not really be worthy of much honor. It just isn't. Like, it's, you know, it's excellent to have an accurate account of the world, including yourself in the world, but you are not actually excelling as a human being if you are not worthy of very much honor.
So the magnanimity is kind of a twofold part, because you have to be worthy of that honor.
Yeah.
You can't be magnanimous if you're not worthy.
Correct.
Of it.
Correct.
So then there's like two.
Yeah. And so he actually uses this phrase at one point, that it's magnanimity is an ornament of the other virtues, like a jewel that kind of crowns the other virtues. You can only have it because of that worthy of honor bit if you have other virtues that make you worthy of honor for something else.
Which is why that's where the eulogy virtues came into play.
Yeah.
Like on the, all these other things.
Yeah.
And then here's an honoring.
And that's the part of that I like.
Thank you.
That's the part of that I liked a lot, Marisa.
So I'm wondering if anybody else has this assumption that I do, which is I have always assumed that magnanimity also embodies humility, that's just woven into it, and that a magnanimous person would, of course, have humility. I mean, that's
it's
just
like at
my
the high end of humility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're on the top side, not on the bottom side.
And so that's where, on the one hand, I gave us that caution at the beginning to make sure we're using the words in the same way. Maybe we are, maybe we're not. I mean, we might actually be here. And but where he talks about that bit about, you know, you're not going to go, like, showing off your awesomeness to try to get extra accolades. In the way that, like, the champion wrestler doesn't go, like, showing off by, like, wrestling a bunch of wimpy kids. Right? So that might be a piece of humility in the sense that you're talking about it. You know,
I don't think you get to be magnanimous if you have no humility.
Yeah.
I mean, they're at odds with you.
Yeah, and so I think the reason why there's that kind of humility, last thought before we walk, right, is that you know that you've made it. And so you desire nothing else from anyone else. And for that reason, you're worthy of honor, right? If you were still desiring to be noticed, right, if you were still desiring to be rewarded, you wouldn't have quite made it all the way. And so you would kind of trivially get a kind of modesty that comes, it's kind of baked into the cake. Trivial because it's baked into the cake. You get it for free if you've gotten the other stuff. Just like the gods, you no longer depend upon others for basically anything. insofar as possible for a human being. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? And so maybe there's a kind of maybe that's one aspect of what we sometimes call humility. But that humility isn't a virtue in its own right. It's only a virtue because you don't actually need anything from other people. Right? To put yourself in a position of pretending as if you didn't need anything from other people when in fact you do would be just a massive cognitive error and would mess up your life. Yeah. Right? So in that sense, humility, the humility that a magnanimous person has doesn't seem like a freestanding virtue, because it's not awesome across the board for anyone. It's only awesome under these very special conditions. Yeah. But let's kind of walk and think and continue these conversations amongst ourselves. I think there's a lot more to unpack. And think of other cases or more about this that you might want to unpack together at the final stop.